And he was like, yeah, sure.
The first method. Let's take a minute, actually. We don't have a quiz today. Let's take a minute and make sure that we're clear about where we're going with the assignment. Okay? So, I was checking the reviews that had come in, and basically we had 64 students, and if we had 4 reviews per student, right, we'd have 256 reviews. We're at about 190, which isn't so bad. So I'll see where everybody is tonight, but what I'll probably do is tomorrow morning I'll email everybody the file with all the comments on everything. And then what you're going to do is look up the comments on your paper. And I'm going to also give you a link to a Google form where you're going to rate each peer evaluator on a scale of 1 to 5. 5 is very helpful, 1 is not helpful at all. And then we'll average those, and that'll be a quiz score. So you'll each get a quiz score for that, and that's separate from your paper grade.
What if someone's, really mad at you?
What?
What if someone's really mad at your review and gives you, a 1?
Well, that's an issue with this peer review stuff. I mean, theoretically, you shouldn't be... Well, how would that work? In other words, if somebody wrote really angry and unhelpful remarks...
Well, what if... constructive, but it still made the person angry.
Oh, I see what you're saying. they gave me really good criticism, but I didn't really want that. I wanted somebody to tell me it was great.
Yeah.
Then don't give them a 1.
If someone does give you...
I know. It can happen. Yeah, I know. If you suspect that, let's talk about it. You know, this happens in publication, because, when I send in an article, sometimes, not so much anymore now, but earlier in my career, you'd send it in for blind review, right? And then the editor would send it out to 5 people or 3 people, and you'd get anonymous review comments. And sometimes that happens. It's like, who is this? I want to know. That wasn't fair. Or sometimes they really have a criticism that you need to address, and the editor says, we can't publish it, or you need to address this before we publish it. So you guys, I really like the idea of keeping you as parallel in what you're doing to what we do as intellectuals and academics. I mean, you're doing the same thing. Okay, so anyway, that's a question, yeah.
You didn't assign grades to them yet, did you?
I'm waiting for a final draft.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So do we get points just for having done the rough draft, or?
There are systems where you do that. I haven't thought about doing that. I figure if you don't do the rough draft, you're not doing as well. That's going to be your own reward. Yeah. Okay. Other questions about this? Okay. So tomorrow morning you're gonna get all the comments back. I'd encourage you to
do the back evaluations soon, and I'll send you the link for that. And you have until next. So you have a whole week. Plenty of time to come in with your paper. What students are doing, and I would ask you not to blow your anonymity.
Some of you were frustrated with the review, with the method I had before. And so you emailed me, and some of you emailed me and said, "Hey, I'm so and so walrus or whatever." And I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good at forgetting. I have a terrible memory, so that kind of helps with the whole anonymity thing. But if you could avoid doing it, that'd be good. And plenty of students have come in with their papers, and we just sit there. I don't have to read the paper. I mean, you work from your paper, and we have a kind of conversation about it, and it doesn't compromise your anonymity at all. Okay, so don't feel like you can't come talk to me about your paper because of the anonymity. I just don't need to know which animal you are right now. Other questions about that? No, I'm really excited about your papers. I mean, this process, I've been doing this for a few years. I used to use a site that everybody had to pay $7, and it was very complex. It was a really cool site, but anyway, it had its own issues. Like, people had credit card problems with the site and everything. It came out of this cognitive psi program and peer reviews. Well, I won't go into it. That's fine. Yeah, you have a question.
Oh, I was going to ask, when you're grading papers, do you grade off animal names prior to knowing who the students are?
Absolutely. That's the whole point. I mean, that's not the whole point, but that's a big part of the point. Yeah. It's also for transparency to be able to share grades. And I would encourage you to read a few others. You read the 4. Did it help you in thinking about your own paper that you read 4 others? It should. And it could, and since you have access to all of them, you can read a few more. Okay, yeah, good. All right. If there's questions about that, let's deal with it. All
All right, today we've got to do some work because we're catching up from a missed class. The worry that faculty typically have is that you're going to lose the narrative of the course, and I don't know how reasonable that is, but I do want to make sure that that doesn't happen. So let's start by just saying a few things about Chapter 4, even though I did give you a little audio on that, and I just want to highlight a couple of things, make sure that we're kind of... I just want to put Chapter 4 in the context of Haidt's argument. So Part 1 is all about this claim, right? Intuition comes first, reasoning second. Part 2 of the book is going to be directed to this thesis. There's more to morality than harm and fairness. And in terms of chapter four is the last chapter in part one. So you've gotten a lot of, in chapters two and three, you got a lot of evidence about how, you know, about the elephant and how powerful automatic processing is. What's cool about chapter four, and this is a good place to start some notes if you haven't already, is that chapter four specifically focuses on research about how bad we are at thinking, right? And that's discouraging. So let's talk about it a little bit. Why are we bad at thinking, according to chapter four? Maybe we could do it from these notes here. Why are we bad at thinking? If you had to pick one main reason why Haidt and why the researchers he cites would say that we're bad at thinking, what would it be? Take a minute. Yeah, good.
It could be that like our thinking is so like affected by like, the situation we're in.
Right.
We know we're going to be accountable. We have to explain our thinking.
Good.
And I think it changes it. So it's like very subjective to the environment.
So one reason, good, I like that. One reason we're bad at thinking is that we try to get away with anything we can, given the context, right? So if the context doesn't hold us accountable, we fudge. If we think the audience doesn't know stuff, we fudge. You know, so that's one reason. We take advantage of environments that don't hold us accountable. But a second reason, anybody? What do we tend to seek out more than we should? Yeah.
Our own hypothesis.
Yeah. Our own confirmation. We tend to seek out evidence that confirms our own thinking. So confirmation bias, right? And the Tetlock research kind of fits in here because the Tetlock research is about conditions under which people will engage in exploratory thought where they're considering other possibilities versus situations in which people are just trying to build a case, right? Confirmatory thought is like the debater when you're just trying to build a case, right? And so we aren't that good at thinking. A third reason we're not that good at thinking is that we're always worried about what everybody else thinks about us. And that kind of makes us conformists, right? So you got three good reasons here to identify the content of, three ways to identify the main content in chapter four. Okay. There's some really important implications to this. So let's see if we can draw those out. I'll just pick out two. One is that we can overcome confirmation bias if we hold ourselves accountable. So that's one most of this chapter is kind of discouraging research about human thinking, right? But one optimistic result from the outcome of this chapter is that we can actually become better thinkers if we make ourselves accountable to others, which is, I think, an insight. Transparency helps with accountability, right? So I can make myself accountable to you to not inflate your grades if I share all the grades with you, right? Say, well, now this grade means something. He's not just giving everybody. The more important consequence from this chapter is this result here. I'll put it to you this way. I'll put it to your notes this way. Maybe this is better. First point, we think we're better thinkers when we think by ourselves. We tend to have a bias toward thinking that we're good thinkers on our own. Second point, it is true that when we think with others, we tend to be swayed by them. We get groupish. So the first point is we tend to think we're good thinkers individually. Maybe that's supported partly because we notice that when we're in groups, we tend to kind of fall in with the group. But that's not good thinking either. And really the third point, and this is really the point that comes out of the chapter's research, good thinking is not solitary. When you're on your own, you're actually most likely to engage in confirmation bias. Good thinking is not solitary. It's one of the dangers. In the history of philosophy, we always have this model of the thinker. You know, usually it's a guy, you know, sitting there like this by himself, right? Good thinking really is social, but you wouldn't notice it because a lot of times in social life, we get groupish. We just start, like, agreeing with the people that we like. So the key thing to notice is that good thinking is an emergent property from social networks that are accountable. You got that? Good thinking is social, but it has to have accountability features. That means you... Yeah, go ahead.
So when you're discussing, like, solitary leads to more conformity thinking, I guess I kind of think of, like, criminal solitary confinement kind of thing. Like, people who tend to commit, like, more, like, serious, like, crimes, like, racially biased crimes,
sure,
tend to be, like, solitary.
Oh, that's interesting. So you could... You could that's kind of an abnormal psych process, right?
Interesting.
Yeah, but this is just a conjecture, but I think it's true. A lot of symptoms of mental illness involve noticing people getting off by themselves. Is that kind of where you're going? Yeah, we're really a social species. I mean, there's no question about it. But it doesn't follow from that we're always at our best when we're in groups, because we have this group psychology, right? We want to be part. We're always checking to see how our group is praising us and whether we're okay with our group. So yeah, but that's a good thing to notice is that unhealthy people often break away and they isolate themselves. And that's, right. So do you have that third point clear? So first point, we tend to think we're good thinkers by ourselves, but that's often when we confirm our biases. Second point, it is true that in groups we're not always good thinkers because we get groupish. Third point, our best thinking might happen in groups when we overcome the factors that make us groupish and uncritical. And that's when we hold ourselves accountable. That's right. That's when we make sure that we invite... one of the most dangerous things for me as a professor is if you guys don't push back. So I hope I'm encouraging you to kind of like raise critical questions, be skeptical... Because then, we're just going to get better thinking that way. And notice the implications of this for politics. I mean, we're going to talk about this some more later in the book. He's going to talk more about political morality. But notice that if this is right, the three points we just made, then you really can't do your best thinking about politics if you just hang out with people who think like you do, right? But that's challenging today, right? Many of you have heard of this phenomenon that the internet seems to promote of creating a kind of bubble where we get the news that seems to fit us. We stay in groups that agree with us. So we tend to ramp up our groupish conclusions about political life, right? Wait for the bells. Start classes. Okay, does that make sense from chapter 4? I don't think I need have anything else I need to get out of chapter 4. So, just to remind you of kind of the overall thing. Okay.
For some reason, I always like to have this little diagram. Because of DeWall. It's kind of good to remember the family tree.
It's So we've got an inset here because the apes get more complicated as you get down to the last couple of million years. Okay, so let's switch gears. Let's switch gears to Dual, and I do want to go back and pick up a couple of things from the second chunk, not the third, the second chunk, which was also part of Monday's class that we didn't have. So here's a diagram that might help us get the Dual lecture together. So Dual's thesis is basic, so let's just kind of get that out right now. Dual's thesis is that human morality is a continuous progression from primate morality. Okay, let's just make sure that's in big, bold letters in your notes. Human morality is a continuous progression from primate morality. It's not different in kind. It's just more sophisticated. That's what he's committed to. Okay? And just to let you know where we're going with this next week we're going to read two philosophers who disagree with Dual. And here's what if they disagree, you can already predict what they're going to say. Both Peter Singer, our old friend Peter Singer, and a really good philosopher, Christine Korsgaard. This is on your reading list for next week. They're both going to argue that human morality is fundamentally different from primate morality. It's not continuous. Okay, is that clear? That's where we're going. So I want to make sure that today we get Dual's argument clear, because it's going to get attacked by two really good philosophers, and I'm torn. I mean, I think one of our jobs is going to be to figure out who's right about what here. And yet we're going to do a small group discussion in this class today it's going to help get us ready for that. Okay. So let's track the argument. Here's my suggestion for a diagram that can help us put a lot of details together. If human morality is continuous with primate morality, then we should be able to arrange Dual's research on a continuum, where on the left side of the continuum we have minimal empathy, and on the right side we have maximal or human, assuming humans are maximally empathetic. That might be controversial. And what we're going to find out is that monkeys can take us so far here, but monkeys have real limits, and that it's really the great apes that show us the path toward human morality. Through emotions like empathy. I'm just going to use empathy as the kind of key, but this also includes sympathy, kindness, care, loyalty, reciprocity. So there's a bunch of moral emotions that we're just going to use empathy as the kind of as a tag for. Okay. By the way, there was a concept earlier in the reading before this that I need to make sure that we understand. Called reciprocal altruism. Can we get that one out? Reciprocal altruism is the tendency to reward altruistic behavior with more altruistic behavior, to return good deeds with good deeds, right? Reciprocal altruism is the tendency to reciprocate altruistically. So when someone does something good for you, reciprocal altruism is the tendency we have to be willing to reciprocate and do something good for them. Do monkeys and primates engage in reciprocal altruism? Yes. Can we get some examples from the reading? Could you get your Dual reading out, and can we make some use of this reading here? So we're in the section. You can cite research from either the 21 to 42 section, or I think this is good. I think what we need is, there's some reciprocal altruism studies in the last section, but let's start with the ones in here. What evidence do we have of reciprocal altruism in monkeys and primates? Yeah, please.
Page 43, same paragraph, says that adults are more likely to share food with individuals who groom them earlier.
Yeah. So there's a grooming study. So But that was with apes or monkeys? Chimps?
Yeah, chimps.
Okay. Chimps or monkeys, if I remember. It's one of the things I have trouble with. Chimps, monkeys? Yeah, I think so. Somebody could check. Grooming reciprocation can go on here. Grooming reciprocity. Also, consoling behaviors are forms of... Wasn't there a study in here about the tendency to console people who are agitated? By the way, on the minimal end of the scale, we've got this concept, emotional contagion. Can we just remind each other what that is? That's a cool concept. Happens all the time. Happens in my life all the time. Yes? Yeah, because the tendency for us to be, the tendency for even fairly small-brained primates, not like us, to directly feel each other's emotions. That's the gloss you need for your, right? Can you think of an example in your experience where you feel emotional contagion? Have you ever seen someone get hurt and said, ouch? Have you ever felt a direct, like, oh, that's gotta hurt?
Yeah.
That's not a contagion. What he has in mind is when a group of kids all get upset because one of the kids falls down and gets hurt, or when with monkeys and apes, when someone does something to upset the equilibrium in a social group, everybody gets excited. That's emotional contagion, right? Okay. But anyway, back to reciprocity. Any other examples of reciprocity here from 21 to 42? Okay, no, I think that's consoling behavior, we got that out. Okay, we're good. We're going to see some more advanced examples of reciprocity back down here when we look at monkey fairness. So let's get that on our chart. Actually, monkeys, we're going to have to extend the monkeys a little bit. So there is something called monkey fairness. We're going to look at the monkey. We might as well do it now. How about that? Remember the monkey fairness study?
In the last part of the... lecture is, I'll get to the page. Page 44. Do you remember this picture here? Remember okay. This is a really complicated experiment. I don't need everything from it. Could you just take a minute and look through from 44 to 46? Just remind me what, let's just remind each other.
This concept, inequity aversion, is important. Yeah, please.
I just have a question.
Good, that's fine.
The emotional contagion, how would that be like minimal empathy? Because wouldn't that indicate like empathy? Like, isn't feeling other people's emotions what empathy is?
Yeah, so this is minimal because it's just, it doesn't involve any... necessarily any constructive action. So as you get to the more complex forms of empathy, you're going to see examples where apes especially aren't just feeling the raw emotion. They're actually...
Acting on it?
Yeah, they're acting on it. They're acting on a perception of another person's need, right? And maybe I can work this in here soon, but let me just get inequity aversion out. That's a good question. Did that get at it? No?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want, maybe if you had the more complex versions, you'd see how this is a simple version. Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Inequity aversion. Anybody do the monkey? What was the experiment involving monkeys and tasks? And yeah, it was really cool.
The monkeys, they're a pair of partners, and then
good.
They're either given a token and then they take that token for like a treat, and it was like cucumbers, which they kind of liked, and grape, which they
really love. Grape. I love
grape. And the monkeys whose partners had it easier than them were less likely to make the exchange.
Yeah.
Than the
yeah.
Player.
Good. So if one monkey saw the other monkey getting a better deal, they would seriously, right? Hey, well, you gave him a grape for what he did. So if one monkey sees the other monkey getting a better deal, they're less likely to complete the task or accept the reward,
well, I'm not going to take anything from you. Look, you're not fair. That's pretty cool, right? That's pretty sophisticated. So monkey fairness is about, as far as Duval is concerned, that's about the limit of, one thing monkeys won't do is they won't, you guys doing? You pulling up monkey videos there? Oh, great. Yeah. Somebody told me in the other class there is a video of this.
Hey,
you're watching it? Yeah.
The grape and the cucumber video.
Yeah, yeah, good. Could you send me the link to that? Yeah, that'd be great. And stop watching it. Pay attention. Yeah, yeah, we can all watch it. No, let's get it up there. It would be a good thing to show if we had a little more time. It's pretty cool because at one point in the video, if I remember it, the monkey just like takes the tray and just goes, what the hell with this? You know? Yeah.
I was wondering, like, the last question kind of about, like the continuum.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of that paragraph on 49,
good.
It was talking about, or at the beginning of page 49, it was talking about how, like, human fairness is different from, like,
yeah, good. Right,
and,
right.
But like, does that, you know, because they don't think of it in a sense of like wanting to share.
Right.
It, like, because they feel like they got the better reward, so they feel like bad or something,
right.
Like guilt, like they don't have that. But does that, like, that doesn't ever get on the monkey?
He does cite Capuchins who also are monkeys. Who will share outside of the maternal, most sharing of food occurs within family structures for primates, but he cites Capuchins are the only monkeys he's aware of who will share outside of their parent relationships. Is that, yeah. Yeah, was that your point?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good, please.
With things like sharing, though, like how do you differentiate between what is like humanly taught and
good.
What is humanly innate? Because I feel
good.
Like,
good.
Sharing is something that we
good.
Learn that we have to do.
Absolutely.
Since,
good.
You know,
good. Let me get at that by, actually, that's a very timely question because so reciprocal altruism would, a minimal example would be grooming reciprocity, but let's take a look at how sophisticated humans are. This is going to be a nice moment for giving ourselves a, you know, pat on the back as a species. So, you know, we're all human, so we can agree on this. In humans, reciprocal altruism isn't just, you know, I'll pick nits out of your hair if you pick nits out of my hair. It's much more complicated, right? We have something, put this in your notes, we have something called delayed reciprocal altruism. That's where I help you, and you remember. And then next week, maybe you help me. That's delayed. We have really complex delayed reciprocal altruism where it goes like this. So this is, so far we're talking about pairs, right? You know, you help me, I help you. But think about what humans do. We have delayed reciprocal altruism where I help you, you help her, she helps you, and then you help me. You notice it doesn't, for humans, because we can remember, we can keep track, we don't always have to make it an immediate reciprocation. And now we're talking about like a group that feels obligated to each other, right? Yeah.
It's like that. Like, pay it forward.
Yeah,
absolutely. You're like an entire group of people, like, buy your food for you, and then you, like, feel like you literally have to, like, buy something.
Yeah.
Food.
Yeah.
Or you'd be, like, a horrible person.
Absolutely. And, you know, think about when you felt really scared or where your moral world shrinks and you get very self-interested and you don't want to be. So, psychologically, we sometimes feel more expansive about this and less expansive about this. And so, yeah, that's really good. Yeah. Well,
the opposite of like the opposite of
reciprocal
altruism. So like, say something, somebody does something
bad to
you.
Oh sure, absolutely.
What is it?
Yeah, it would be is altruistic punishment is the research concept I'm aware of. It's when that's a more specific concept than maybe what you're asking about. Punishment. Yeah, I remember. And notice social status and reputation follow. If I see you refusing to help her when you should have, then my estimation of her goes down. Like, well, maybe you're not a good cooperator, you know? So yeah, but altruistic punishment is when you punish people even though you're not going to benefit from the punishment. You're just enforcing a rule, like, you're a bad person, I'm going to call you out. That's a little more specific than what you're asking for.
Okay, so there isn't like a delayed or punishment in terms of like you do, because I was just curious because I don't know, I'm thinking in the terms of, like, very simple,
yeah.
But, like...
How about talking stink about people? That's
well,
punishment.
Well,
that's
even, like,
right?
Less
gossip.
Than that,
if we,
like,
yeah, we'll take care of this. We'll tell everybody what you just did.
Like a prank war or something.
What?
Going on, like that kind of a thing.
Say it again.
Like a prank war.
Yeah, you could see an escalation of tit for tat, right? We are going to get into, like, tit for tat is a strategy where we're going to get into this later. I won't go into too much, but just to explain it, tit for tat is a strategy where. Every time you defect in a cooperative scheme with me, I'm going to defect the next time with you. But every time you help me, I'm going to help you. So it's reward. It's what you're getting at, really, more directly. It's like,
yeah.
It's the fact that we don't just keep track of altruists, we keep track of defectors.
So,
does that make sense?
So they work similarly?
Absolutely.
Or do they...
Absolutely. I think so. I mean, you'd want to look at some research on this. I don't see so much research on, aside from altruistic punishment, but theoretically they should work the same. Just like I should say, oh, you know, you can really count on her. She's great. You know, she helped me out, you know, the other day, and I didn't have to, like, do something immediately for her, you know. But likewise, you could say, wow, you know. You know what it's like to be, like, held in a lower estimation by some. Good. Okay, so we engage in these more complex. So that's a way of locating humans. So put on your chart. We should really have put human reciprocation over here. So I'll put human delayed reciprocation, right? Because that's something that only species with big brains can do. Because you have to keep track, right? You have to remember. Okay, that's good. Let's keep moving. This is good. Here's what I want to get at, though. One way to think of this continuum is that the more you have of something called theory of mind, let's go ahead and explain this. It's always abbreviated T-O-M. Sorry. T-O-M, like that. Theory of mind, I'm going to gloss it for you, and then we'll kind of explain where it fits into the continuum. Theory of mind is... the capacity we have to read each other's minds. Pretty cool. Yeah. Woo. I'm going to make it sound spooky so it sounds more interesting. It is really interesting. Theory of mind is the capacity that animals have to form a conception of another person's intention and take it into account in their action. And, right?
So this kind of be like, not literally reading mind, but more like reading the body language, learning from experience, and just kind of piecing it together to get it.
You're using experience, but hey, I don't want to back off the mind reading thing. I think we do read each other's minds. Can you just get, let's get a few examples. How many times did, when did, give me an example. It happens all the time. I'm reading your minds right now. Sorry, keep it private. I can't look into your minds and read them. But we're always reading each other's minds. Can you make it concrete for us?
Well, I don't know if this works very well, but me and, like, my best friend, we, like, do things at the same time all the time without telling each other.
Okay.
We're, like,
right.
A very vague example. We both finished Westworld at the same time, like,
okay.
Within a minute, without even knowing we started it.
That's fun. That's
so.
Fun. Yeah. Good.
Well, then, like, if someone asked you to do a favor for them and you say no, you can tell them, like, can tell, even though they don't like say it out loud, you can tell that they're like hurt, and so you kind of like change your opinion because you know that
absolutely
actually
we betray each other all the time. We have 200 muscles in our face, and we can if you're a good poker player, you can control them, right? I'm not a good poker player. I'm always betraying myself. But you know, you can sometimes see. Have you ever noticed a little flash of disgust? Like that was kind of your example. Sometimes you just kind of a little flash of disappointment. How about when we finish each other's sentences? That's reminding. What else?
Like when your manager or your coworker is like, "Can you come in?" Like, or like, I mean, the only time would be like if they say it to your face, which has happened to me multiple times before. But they're like, "Oh, can you work on this day? Like, we really need you." Like, so and so called in. They called in. You just like, if you like can't, and you're like, "No, I literally can't," then they're like.
Okay, you mean, you think...
Their face is like, you can tell that they can't, like,
like they look, they're good. So mad and like annoyed, but they like know they can't like actually
right.
freak out because you like weren't scheduled.
Like you can almost tell that they're biting their tongue.
Yeah.
Like if they were not, if it was not a sophisticated person, they would kind of like make a face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another example.
I'll be eating dinner with my friends.
Yeah.
And you can just tell when someone's had a bad day.
Absolutely.
Like they're just, they won't talk.
Absolutely.
They're just kind of like staring at their plate or
yeah.
maybe they're not saying anything.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That.
We read each other's minds from our body language, from facial expression, even if we're good at keeping it in. Yeah.
I was new. If I came home late in high school, my dad would be on the couch, wouldn't say a word to me, just blank stare at
That's
me.
Awesome.
And it was like, you knew you were in
yeah.
trouble. There was no.
Yeah,
didn't
need
to
say
anything.
It. Right,
wasn't
right.
even give you the chance to like,
yeah,
explain
absolutely.
Yourself. It was just like,
yeah.
Done.
Good. Yeah. So humans, we're really complicated about this. We can tell what you're thinking. We can even say, okay, here's something you're thinking, and then the other person can confirm it, right? So what about examples in Deval? Do we have examples of mind reading in Deval among primates and chimps? It's kind of in the middle here, maybe the anecdotes. You remember some of those? Cooney and the starling. Remember, Cooney was this great ape who got somehow wound up holding this bird or helping this bird, and then what Cooney does is get the bird and kind of go like that. How does that involve a theory of mind between the ape and the bird? What does Cooney know about the bird?
Fly.
Yeah, birds fly. Then you have to kind of give them a little shove, maybe. So Cooney has a model, a very rudimentary theory of bird minds, right? What about Jackie helping Crom with the tires? Do you remember that? Crom was trying to get the water out of a tire that was on the end of a road of tires, and she couldn't get to it, right? And then Jackie, I think, is her niece or something. And what does Jackie do? Do you remember that story? Jackie watches her frustrated. So Jackie watches her try to do something. Forms a conception of what she's trying to do. So that's theory of mind. So put this in your notes. When you guess somebody's goal, right, you're reading their mind. Right? Cooney's trying to get the water out of the last tire. She couldn't figure out how to do it. So Cooney gives up Crom gives up, and Jackie comes and says, oh, I know what you're trying to do. Doesn't say it because they don't have language, but you know, I know what you're trying to do. I've got a theory of your mind. Moves the tires, and lo and behold, she gets the. Why does Lady Jean, this is one of my favorite quiz questions, I didn't get to answer it, ask you this semester. How does Lady Gina Coates get her chimpanzee off the roof? Do you remember this one? She acts like she's in pain. Why? Because the chimp's like, oh wow, I've got to come help. Lady, this is her gal, you know? So the chimp has a theory of mind. Lady Gina Coates is in pain. I better come help her. You even have this example of sometimes zoo gorillas kill kids and sometimes they rescue them. Hit or miss. You know, so, but in this case, you know, the zoo gorilla kind of got the idea, right? Theory of mind seems partly related. So apes, so put it in your notes this way, apes go much further than monkeys in terms of the complexity of their theory of mind. One hypothesis DeWall has for this, okay, so get that in your notes. Apes go much further. Apes can form more complex models of what the other person wants. And one phrase in the reading was targeted helping. Targeted helping is when you know what the other person's trying to get. And, you know, that's a pretty sophisticated thing. But one hypothesis that DeWall has for why apes go further is that apes have MSR, mirror self-recognition. Apes can recognize themselves in a mirror. That's pretty cool. That seems indicative of a more sophisticated sense of oneself in relation to others. Do any of you have pets who recognize themselves in mirror? It's weird. Notice that we select pets for their ability to empathize with us. So you've got like the example of a kid upset, the family dog comes and nuzzles, right? Isn't that wonderful? It's because we You don't think that's wonderful?
Well, the thing is, I've always been like a snake or
okay. And they don't, the snakes don't nuzzle really. Yeah, they don't get that.
That's
great.
So, like,
there's
several news articles stating that, in our generation, empathy has, decreased.
Good.
How do all, respond
right.
to that and
good.
Keep progressing?
Good. Actually, our small group, she's citing research that suggests that empathy is decreasing today. There's some research that ties it to social media and technology, right? That's really interesting stuff, and that's very relevant to our small group thing. Let's wait and do that. It's a couple minutes. We're almost there. Okay? So that's part of this picture, is that what makes humans and great apes more sophisticated in empathy is because they have more complex models of what's going on in other people's minds. Okay. All right. So we got the monkey fairness thing out. Okay. Good. All right. So here's the small group experience. I'm glad we're here now because I want to get you guys working. The more work, you're doing some great work already, but I want to get you talking to each other. We've had a couple of different. Well, let's see. Let me think about how to put this succinctly. Here's the question. Okay, here's the question for your discussion. Are evolved moral emotions still relevant to human morality? Are moral emotions still relevant to human morality? And I'm going to give you the sketch of where you would go here. Let's see. Clearly, DeWall thinks so, in case you're wondering. But remember, do you remember how you would get the no answer? People like Peter Singer, right, would say, remember the kid in the pond, that you have to save? Singer's point there was it doesn't matter whether the kid is in the pond and you have an emotional reaction to the kid, or the kid is 6,000 miles away in an African country that you never met. Notice that Singer would argue that moral emotions often get in the way of understanding our obligations, because moral emotions also tie us to groups, right? So I've painted a picture here which I think supports DeWall's belief that moral emotions aren't just part of our evolutionary past. They're part of the machinery that we do morality with. But I want you to discuss the possibility that he might be wrong. I mean, next week you're going to get extended arguments from two philosophers on the no side. You already know that Singer thinks that the key move in morality as a utilitarian is to realize that your happiness is as important to you as mine is to me, and that puts all of us on an equal footing, regardless of whether we feel empathy for each other. So Singer would say moral emotions actually get in the way sometimes of recognizing our obligations. But I don't know if I'm ready to go with him on that. So could you get in small groups and kind of consider, do moral emotions still do important work for humans, or are they as likely to help to make us miss our obligations? Okay, can you get forming groups, move your chairs, roll toward people, lean toward their elephants, introduce yourself, and try to keep track of some of the reasons you come up with.
Like his moral emotion. doctor was Jewish and she died. She lost water. So like it's like more of a
For example, like pushing a large man off.
Or not.
Like
if that's
not
couple minutes, guys, okay?
Partially, like your wife cheating.
Not right.
Planned it.
It's a little over.
But,
like,
yeah.
Much more west.
it was just a instinctual.
Okay, maybe take 30 seconds to wrap up your points. And then. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, maybe you could come together. Okay. Thanks. It sounded like some good discussion. Just the fact that we have something in our evolutionary past doesn't mean that it's still serving us, right? So it's a reasonable question. And then next week we're going to get these philosophers who are definitely going to say no. What came out of your groups? What kinds of considerations might help you decide this question?
So we kind of looked at an example where like morality would play a strong role, and that was like murdering someone, which is like a little bit extreme.
Good.
But so like initially we talked about how like the reason we think murder is wrong is because like we're emotionally tied to like people and think like, oh, loss of life is like bad for emotional reasons. But then also like emotion can drive you to murder someone in like a crime of passion.
Ah, good point. Good.
And so it's kind of like it like operates on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. Good. So there's a duality to emotions. You can come up with examples where emotions could be involved in a bad moral outcome or a good one, right? So your first point was interesting, especially to me, because it sounded like you were saying emotions can be part of the motivational structure of our morality. If knowing the right thing to do and doing it are not necessarily the same, right? Doing the right thing means you're motivated. Get yourself to do it. You could always say, well, you know, I should be more honest, but you know, lying works pretty well for me. So what would motivate you not to lie? Well, it could be that you notice that you got caught and now somebody doesn't trust you. Nobody calls you to go out. I mean, that would kind of like, yeah, well, they cheated on the bill last time. I'm not going out with him. You know? What else came out of your groups? Yes.
We were kind of looking at the question I think you originally posted as, are evolved moral emotions still relevant to
Good.
Human morality?
Good.
And we kind of came to the conclusion that we didn't like the question because relevant was like, I mean, if humans have emotion, then they play a part innately, like,
good.
So we said, should they be the central focus?
Yeah, do they help? That's much better. Yeah, so do moral emotions still help? Presumably they used to still help us.
Yeah, and then we used the term developing instead of evolved.
Well, you really didn't like the question at all.
No, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Now it's all a big mangle. I didn't even write it right.
And then
final version of the question you liked?
Are developed moral emotions the center point to human morality?
Good.
And
giving yourself
I,
some room then.
Yeah. And I said no, because when you think about people are
central.
Different parts of their moral development, I mean, you just look at IQ, like that can innately change within a person. That is something that can grow and evolve. People are evolving.
Okay.
So since that act is not something that you can put in the past, it is like a current action unless someone's dead, they're not evolving anymore. But because that changes so much between people, you can't necessarily say that that would be a good place to get all of the answers. So instead, you have to, and at the point where you bring the intersectional aspects like the environment, the type of people involved in the situation, reason, and your emotions, and then to reach an intersectional center point, and that's the next point.
I mean, one hunch you guys should have as good thinkers and good philosophers is anytime somebody offers you yet an alternative, you always kind of want to be wondering about this, right? Or neither, right? So I hear you saying this. It can both. And the early answer we got about, you know, emotions keeping you from murdering something or someone or causing you to, that could also be both, right? What else? Yeah?
Kind of along with what she was saying, we're talking about psychopaths and how,
right,
without their inability to feel, like,
right,
empathy and that some of the decisions they make, obviously, are...
Right, Damasio's research isn't really about psychopaths, but let's just add this here. Psychopaths also, remember, they reason but don't feel. So Damasio's research, remember, was on patients that couldn't experience emotion and then couldn't do planning. So it suggests that our emotional capacities are related to goal orientations and maybe motivation. But the psychopath also has that problem, and that having just reason doesn't look like moral behavior either, right? So, but these both give us a way of looking at one without the other. Yeah, please.
And then, kind of said, like, we thought it did just because...
Good.
Just, like, your moral values, how you know the difference between wrong and right is, like, you have an emotional connection to that.
Yeah.
That, like, tells you that feel or tells you whether or not you think that's good or right. And it's not like there's a rule book that every human looks into, like, is cheating on a test good, or whatever that looks like, or is
good
calling people names bad, and, like,
good,
you don't have just, like, a rule book like that. That's
right.
Just something you emotionally feel that you've been told, because you have that emotional connection to
it. Can I put this back? Tell me if I'm getting it right. Modern humans still engage in emotional moral training. We still bring up kids to feel bad about doing crappy stuff.
Yeah.
And if we didn't do that, could we just wait till they became adults and say, well, have you heard of the principle of utility? Here, you just have to think about this universally and rationally. I don't know if that would work. Yeah, so very good. Yes answer. Yes, Emma.
In addition to that, we also brought up the hypothetical of say that there's a rule that maybe people, like, some higher authority deems is best for everyone,
mm-hmm,
but an individual, like, deems it amoral, and so they, like, go against that rule and choose to not follow the order.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So, and that would be acting on their emotions against, like, this other thing, and so that motivation, that emotion plays into, like, how they would view the rules as it.
Are you thinking about a case where the rules are maybe morally bad and the individual has to rebel?
Yeah,
good. That's a good example. Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it's our feeling of injustice that brings the first motivation to push back against even our own group and say, no, we can't do that. That's not right. Yeah, good. We've got time for a few more, and then I've got a little more content to get in here. Yeah.
Well, like, I guess this would go under yes, but we were talking about, too, how in the legal system, like, if you murder someone without, like, planning it, like, it's an act of passion or whatever, you get less time.
Oh, interesting.
Versus if you, like, planned it out, then it's, like, and, like, as, like, viewers of, like, say you were watching a trial or whatever, you would have some, like, sense of feeling bad for the person being convicted if, like, their wife was cheating on them or something, or, like, you know, you knew they had, like, a reason for it emotionally, like, that's why they did it.
Yeah,
versus,
good.
Like, if it's, like, a psychopath and they, like, have been killing and murdering people for, like, a year with just unchecked for no reason, then, like, you have no really sympathy for them, so it's kind of like our emotions that play into like how harshly we judge them, and like
absolutely
so far as even to go with our like laws.
Yeah. So we use emotions in the process of making very fine-tuned judgments about culpability and desert and sympathy for people who even do something wrong. That's really neat. That's a good complicated example. Okay, a couple of things just to kind of get into your notes. One is this PAM concept, perception action mechanism, is the idea that perception and action in our brains share cognitive representations. So there's a very natural connection between perceptual experience, which is emotionally rich, and action. So that would suggest that yes, there's still a very strong connection if that model is right. So we did those. Other people, like Singer, would say no for a lot of reasons, but one reason he would say no is that ethics, modern ethics, you think about human rights, you think about environmentalism, is often about expanding the circle, right? So this is a metaphor that people use to talk about how modern morality is about getting over our emotional commitments to people near us and recognizing that the circle of moral concern is bigger than we thought. So you think about 200 years ago, Western Europeans thought non-Europeans were pretty much not humans. Non-Europeans from traditional cultures were pretty much non-humans. So expanding the circle meant treating all humans as humans, including slaves. And also sometimes we say that impartiality is a virtue, but that impartiality is about setting aside our partiality. So you know, it's going to be both, but we're going to have to try to figure out what the mix looks like at a theoretical level. That's what next week's work is largely about. Two things I need to get into your notes here. I did this at the beginning in the other section, but I think it might make more sense to do here. Height is going to, in the next section of the book, height is going to tell us that we actually have, he's going to add a sixth one later in the book, but we actually have five moral, emotional foundations. So I want to get this into your notes. The acronym is going to be CFLAS. If you have trouble remembering things like this, then you could use that. Care, fairness, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. And what he's going to say is that for each one, there's a kind of duality. So care is related to, the opposite of care is harm. The opposite of fairness is cheating. The opposite of loyalty is betrayal. The opposite of authority is subversion. The opposite of sanctity is degradation. This is a big theory. It's going to take several chapters to unpack. The reason I'm bringing it up here is that it's part of the yes answer, right? What Haidt is going to argue is that we evolved a core group of moral emotions because we had challenges in our ancestral environment, challenges relating to taking care of each other, taking care of kids, being loyal to each other, being in solidarity with our group, which he and others argue conferred a selective advantage to us. Yes, please.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry.
So after you listed all of these, then
that was
what
a
did
lot.
You say?
Sorry. Yeah, good. That's the important part.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. Sorry. That's good.
That's
helpful. So Haidt is going to tell us that we have five, and then he'll add a sixth. But we have five basic core moral emotions, and they came to us through evolution. Because in our evolutionary past, we had challenges that we met, and we met these challenges by, in part, through enforcing these emotions. Challenges like taking care of kids, being fair in a group, being loyal. Sometimes, and having authority, recognizing authority in groups, that's been good for humans, right? Effective human organizations recognize leadership, maybe. But then sometimes we have to rebel. So the capacity to subvert authority is also part of our matrix. So I bring this up because it's part of the yes answer. So thanks for getting me to go through that a little more reasonable pace. And we're going to learn more about it. I don't need to say more about it now, but in each case, he's going to show us how. I'll just do this one, okay? Sanctity and degradation come from, according to Haidt and others, come from our ancestral need to distinguish foul food from healthy food. to distinguish diseased people from who often look kind of gross from healthy people, because we're supposed to associate, you know, because our success depends on avoiding poisonous food and diseased people, right? So we have a disgust reaction to things that are gross and degrading in a moral sense, because we evolved from a disgust reaction to gross and degrading food and people. Okay, so that's kind of the we're going to get more of that later. The other thing I wanted to get into your notes before you break is reciprocal altruism in humans has been studied through a research game called the ultimatum game. So let me just explain that to you. So let me get to the point. So reciprocal altruism in humans can be studied through a simulation game called the ultimatum game. I'm just going to explain it to you, and we're going to study it later in the semester, but I want to connect it to our discussion here. Here's how the ultimatum... Anybody heard of the ultimatum game? Maybe you didn't? Okay. So here's how it works. People are paired up, and one person is given a sum of money, let's say $10. You've heard of this, okay. And they have to decide how much to share with the other person. So we give you $10, and you get to decide how much to give her. If she doesn't think that she got a fair amount, she can say, forget it, and neither of you get any money. You've heard of this? Okay, good.
It was in one of our readings.
Oh, already? Has it already come up? Good. It comes up in two or three places in the... Okay, but let's pay a little... Let's focus on it. So what do we find out? Well, if you believe in classical economics, you should be okay with a dollar from the 10, or a penny, right? So one way of thinking about it is, it's fair if you just are made a little better off. So if you thought people were fundamentally self-interested, and all you had to do was make them better off, and they'd be satisfied, then that's what you would predict, that the ultimatum game would work as long as she got something. Are you with me? Yeah, Mark, Laura.
No, I'm starting to think I might have, maybe it didn't come from this late reading, because I think there, either it wasn't or I don't know. Anyway, I recently was hearing something like, that when that happens, it was an NPR thing, so... When I'm like trying to connect.
That's okay.
So within this study, they found that a majority of the time people did 50-50 until they were taught this.
And then they did less. That's funny.
But then it still just went to like an average of like $6 or $7. So
okay.
Like not a lot.
There's a lot of research on this. I mean, we're going to get into some of that, but that's great that you're connecting with that. I'm just going to give you two or three pieces like that. Okay. It turns out, I think the average for Westerners is about 25%. So if she gives less than $2 or $3, she'll say no. That's ridiculous. Come on. Sociocentric cultures have a higher minimum, so the sense of fairness is tied to that. The point here, though, is that we have a kind of disgust reaction to someone who doesn't, who would just share the least amount, and the point is that that suggests we're operating with a concept of fairness which is bigger than just self-interest. See, if we were just, I'll just make the point again. If we were just operating with self-interest, we'd take something rather than nothing. The hard thing to explain is why would you turn down $2? Right? You're $2 richer. And the answer is because you're not just deciding it based on self-interest. You're also using one of these moral foundations. It just doesn't seem fair for her to only give you $2 out of 10. She just got the money. She didn't do anything for it. You see how the fairness judgment kicks in? Now, if it was her earnings, you don't expect anything. So the point is that we actually do use evolved concepts of things like fairness, which show up in the record for primates. And so maybe morality really does make use of evolved moral emotions, right? Does that make sense? Okay, should we stop there? Okay. See you guys.